Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, reaction to a Burma court sentencing of the country's top pro-democracy activist to another 18 months of house arrest. How easy is it for a reporter in the Holy Land to remain impartial while covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And we look ahead at the Feast of the Assumption by going to a special Marian shrine in Jerusalem. The trial of Aung San Suu Kyi concluded today with a Burmese court finding the pro-democracy leader guilty of violating her house arrest and ordering her to serve a further 18 months under house arrest. The 64-year-old Nobel Peace Laureate has already been in detention for 14 of the last 20 years, mostly under house arrest. And the extension will remove her from the political scene when the military junta stages elections next year. The sentence has drawn immediate criticism from around the world, with British Prime Minister Gordon Brown calling it monstrous. But the term was less severe than the maximum sentence she faced, 5 years in prison, and shorter than the one the court initially ordered Tuesday, 3 years with hard labor. South Africa's Archbishop Desmond Tutu charged that the reduced sentence was not a concession. It is a manipulation of an illegal process, he said. It must not be accepted by any government. Burma Campaign UK, an activist group, has called for a global arms embargo against Burma and said the junta was determined to silence all pro-democracy voices in the country. The director of the human rights group, Mark Farminer, told John Kelly how he expects the international community to respond.
The verdict was not a surprise at all. The whole trial was a sham designed to give the regime, in their eyes, a legitimate reason for keeping her in detention. They've got their eyes on one thing only, and that's elections planned in 2010. These elections bring in a new constitution which legalizes the dictatorship's rule. So they're seeing these elections as giving them legitimacy. And the last thing they want is someone like Aung San Suu Kyi to be free and speaking out to the people of Burma, to the international community about what's really going on in the country and how the whole roadmap to democracy that the regime claim they have is a complete lie.
Do they not seem to realize that the international community almost sees through this?
Unfortunately, the international community don't see through the games that the regime are playing. Many countries have welcomed the elections next year, even though these elections will be completely rigged and bring in a constitution that actually legalizes dictatorship. At the same time, we've seen that the regime has been playing a very careful game here. They want to make sure they get Aung San Suu Kyi out of the way and silence her. At the same time, they're afraid of a strong international response and sanctions. So they ramp up the expectation of a harsh sentence, saying that she could get 5 years in hard labor. Then they pull back, giving her 18 months under house arrest. They can present themselves then as saying, look, we're lenient, we're responding to international concerns. And unfortunately, many governments will fall for that. Many observers will fall for that and say, oh, is this a positive sign? You know, they haven't been as extreme as they could have been. They might even get praise for extending her house arrest from some governments such as India, Japan, and China. So they're very good at playing this game. They've been doing it for 20 years. You have here one of the most brutal dictatorships in the world, consistently defying the United Nations Security Council, General Assembly, and other bodies, and yet have escaped any serious consequences for their actions at all. So now is going to be a real test. We saw when this trial started in May, real outrage from the international community, and it's time to see now whether they're going to deliver with real tough, concrete steps, whether they've finally woken up and understand that this is not a regime that can be negotiated with. They're going to have to be forced out of power. There's going to be tough actions such as a global arms embargo, an investigation into their crimes against humanity taking place. These are the kind of things that will finally get the generals to pay attention to the international community.
Suu Kyi was found guilty of violating the terms of her house arrest by harboring an American, John Yetta, who swam across a lake to sneak uninvited into her compound. The 53-year-old man was sentenced Tuesday to 7 years, including 4 years hard labor. He reportedly suffers from diabetes and epileptic seizures.
John Yetto was given 7 years hard labor. Now, this is, another game that the generals are playing. They aren't interested in whether they've got him in jail or not. They're becoming increasingly close to the dictatorship in North Korea. And I think they see the North Koreans as a role model in some ways. And so they'll be looking at what the North Koreans did when they had the two American journalists in detention there, how they used that for leverage against the U.S. and then got the propaganda coup in their eyes of having Bill Clinton visit the country and meet with them. So I think we can expect, unfortunately for John Yetto, that he will be used as a tool by the generals in Burma to try to influence U.S. policy, to try to persuade them to be perhaps more lenient than they have been in the past towards the generals, and try and get some sort of concessions by releasing him sooner.
From what I've read, John Yetto doesn't seem to be a very healthy man, and they have given him 4 years of hard labor. This doesn't strike me as projecting a very lenient image.
I think they're aware that the main focus of the international community is what's going to happen on Aung San Suu Kyi, and that by not giving her the maximum sentence, you're going to get some reports saying that they have been more lenient than expected, and they will see that as a positive thing in their eyes. For John Yetto, they're giving this harsh sentence. That's designed to put pressure on the U.S. The U.S. has been the harshest critic in the past of the regime. It has the strongest sanctions. There's a policy review going on right now under the Obama administration, and they're going to use John Yetto as a tool to try to influence U.S. policy. We could expect to see something. Perhaps they will be someone that comes in from the U.S. They will probably select someone who they would see as more sympathetic to the regime, and then release John Yetto into his custody to be freed, thereby giving a sort of a U.S. opponent of sanctions a credibility boost. So they'll use him as a tool. It's very, very unlikely that he'll serve any significant length of time in jail.
Just getting back to Suu Kyi for a quick moment. So what is the future now for her? Is she just going to have to serve out her time? And then at the end of that, do we know what may happen?
It really does depend on what people like Obama and Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, decide to do. If the international community continues on the same path that it has been, then Aung San Suu Kyi will face another 18 months in detention, probably. We'll then see that there'll be a new facade a government there that's pretending to be civilian, but the same generals in place, all the human rights abuses still taking place. Or will we really see some tough action like a global arms embargo? The British Prime Minister, very welcome that he's today called on the Security Council to pass a global arms embargo. That's the kind of thing that's going to make the generals in Burma pay attention. The threat of a global arms embargo, the threat of international criminal prosecution, this is leverage that someone like Ban Ki-moon could use if he went to Burma and really threatened them with serious consequences. But unfortunately, when Ban Ki-moon went a month ago to Burma, it was the softly, softly diplomacy that the UN has always used on Burma and that has completely failed for the past 20 years. We didn't see any new approach there. Perhaps now we'll see a new approach, but to be honest, we're not optimistic.
And thanks there to the director of Burma Campaign UK, Mark Farminer, speaking there with my colleague, John Kelly. And now we go over to the Middle East, which has been racked by decades of conflict. Perhaps the one conflict that has defined the rest, the ongoing violence and hatred between Israelis and Palestinians. I often wonder what it must be like for a local journalist in the Holy Land to cover the suicide bombings, the Israeli airstrikes, the occupation. Of that horrible conflict, Pope John Paul II often said, "There can be no peace without justice, and no justice without forgiveness." To this day, the injustices painfully remain. Peace and forgiveness seem unattainable dreams. Living amid the bloodshed and the tears, how can a journalist there maintain a certain impartiality? Choosing sides must be so seductive. Well, I was lucky that freelance journalist Lamia Lahoud, who lives and works in the Holy Land, was recently visiting Rome and stopped into Vatican Radio. I asked her if she could help satisfy my curiosity.
You've seen horrific times and hopeful times. What are some of the moments that will always remain most with you?
When Yitzhak Rabin and King Hussein of Jordan sat together in the desert, and they both looked so happy, and they actually looked like they liked each other, and there was like a feeling of hope, and people were mingling, and everybody was like very happy and trying to get a picture opportunity, you know, with somebody from the Arab side and some of the Arabs from people from the Jewish side. And you really had the feeling that things are going to change, that there was a, you know, a big wave of change. And the same was really true in Taba when they had the negotiations in the very beginning for the Gaza-Jericho Accord. That was before the actual peace agreement. And there was like this feeling of, people were getting to know each other and they were actually forming relationships. So they would sit down, have lunch together, and they would like each other on an individual basis. And that was very, very hopeful because they started to understand each other. And at Camp David, things went a little bit wrong, although there the atmosphere was between some people very good, between others very bad. But then there was like this big blow-up afterwards, which kind of destroyed everybody's hopes, because before that there was a lot of hope and people were looking at a new future, making plans. I mean, there were businessmen from both sides, Jordan, Palestinians, Israelis, who were having joint business ventures ideas and companies who wanted to work together and, you know, tourist ideas, and then it just all fell apart.
It all fell apart in a series of failures by the two sides to find a minimum of common ground. The Camp David meeting in July 2000 ended in stalemate, and the Taba Egypt talks failed after Ariel Sharon, an adversary of Israeli concessions in Oslo and Camp David, was elected as Israeli premier 2 weeks later in February 2001. Lamia remembers hopes for peace soared after the 1993 Oslo Accords and the historic handshake between Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and Israeli Premier Yitzhak Rabin at the White House. Just a few months later, on August 8, 1994, Rabin met Jordan's King Hussein to confirm peace with Israel's Arab neighbor and inaugurate the Aqaba-Eilat border crossing. But the protagonists of those dreams for peace now long gone, few leaders have since found the courage to follow in their footsteps. One of the tragic problems, Lamia explains, has been the failure to get the support of average Palestinians and Israelis for peace.
So many years of suffering on both sides, so much brainwashing also that you can't just erase from one day to the other. Whole generations that were brought up to believe different things, and suddenly they see their leaders sitting together, talking together, you know, talking about peace, and they're asked to make concessions that they were told are impossible, they could never make. So I think it never really went down to the masses. And I kind of agree with the present president of Israel, Shimon Peres, that if there would have been more involvement, you know, like trying to put money in and trying to give more opportunity and trying to reach the people on the ground on both sides, and especially on the Palestinian side, because they really did have a much harder economic situation and they were living in misery in many areas, maybe then there would have been much more response to, you know, to these ideas, which for many were very strange, because it was the rich and the powerful and the people in politics who were all chatting and sitting together yesterday, enemies, today friends. The people on the lower level didn't really get it. So I don't think it was the leadership then. Today, people are tired. People want peace. They're really worn out. Especially on the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side, if you live under constant attack, I think you don't know anymore how to live any different. I mean, you dream of a different, like in Ramallah, for example, people are very hopeful that there will be a peace process because they don't live under constant attack. But if you live in Gaza and you're constantly under attack, you don't really know anymore how to live any different way. So maybe there it's not like that. But in Ramallah, in some of the West Bank cities, in Bethlehem, definitely, and in Israel, people are tired and they just want to finish it and, you know, and move on with their lives. But they have leaderships that are not ready to do that.
You've been living in the region for so many years, and you've been witness firsthand to this conflict. Is it ever difficult for you to remain impartial when reporting?
Yes, but it also changes, like, on what side of the divide you are. Like, let's say when you're sitting in Gaza and you see a bomb fall on a building where there are, you know, civilians in the building and 14 children get killed, you want to cry and your heart breaks. Then when you stand in front of the Dolphinarium and you see, you know, a young man blow himself up, killing all these young, beautiful, you know, boys and girls that are going out to have a good time, then you get angry and your heart breaks there. So in these moments, of course, you're torn, and it's very, very difficult. But I think not really, because the thing is, there has to be some kind of justice. Okay, we know the realities on the ground. They will not be changed. And, I mean, everybody has their personal feeling about that. But you have to work with those realities and try to make the best that creates a human, just situation for both sides, a situation in which both people can actually make a better life, have a future, and that's the only way that they will ever achieve peace. And to get rid of all kinds of hatred, radicalism, fanaticism, you know, fundamentalism, whatever, to rid yourself of these things and move forward. And I think that it's not so difficult, because one thing that is very, very special, especially when you're reporting in Israel, is that in all the trouble, you always find these amazing stories of courage, you know, of people that just go against the flow and take personal risks and stand up for what they believe. You know, mothers whose sons have been killed by Palestinians go and stand at the checkpoints to make sure that the soldiers don't mistreat, you know, Palestinians who are passing the checkpoints and things like that. I mean, they're just unbelievable. Or the mother of a Palestinian child who received an Israeli heart, or vice versa. They meet, they sit, they you know, they hug each other, they bond suddenly. And then you have doctors that go to the Palestinian areas, bring the children over together with Palestinian doctors, and they give them surgery. You know, you have a lot of courage, things that are happening on both sides that really gives you the feeling that, yes, the situation is kind of deadlocked, but it's, if you look at history, it's always been a difficult place. But it's also a place that has a lot of hope and a lot of potential, and there are a lot of beautiful stories in the tragedy and that show you that there's a possibility to really have some kind of humanity and justice for both people.
And a warm thanks there to Lamia Lahoud, a freelance journalist based in the Holy Land. Each year, the Catholic Church remembers the Assumption of Our Lady into Heaven on August 15th. Different traditions hold that the Virgin Mary left this earthly life between 3 and 15 years after Christ's death and resurrection. She was assumed into heaven, accounts say, as she reposed in eternal sleep, either in Jerusalem or in Ephesus, in modern-day Turkey. While early accounts from the Holy Land reported that a Christian cult venerating Christ's mother had grown up around a place on Jerusalem's Mount Zion, just south of the old city walls. The spot, known from early times as Hagia Maria, continues to this day to be the site of prayers to Our Lady. Today, German-speaking Benedictine monks care for the Catholic Church of the Door Mission, built there over the ruins of a series of early Christian shrines. Today, the monks serve the church, its guests, and pilgrims, and work for peace and reconciliation in the Holy Land. Well, I sat down with the noted scholar and author Father Peter Stravinskas, who has led us on reflections on the holy sites in the land of Christ's birth, to ask him his thoughts on this Jerusalem shrine, celebrating the Virgin's death and assumption into heaven.
Yes and no. The church is in the care of German Benedictine monks. It's a beautiful, beautiful church for people who watch EWTN and have seen Father Mitch Pacwa's rosary from the Holy Land. He does the Mystery of the Assumption from the Church of the Dormition. The Dormition is the Eastern word for what we celebrate on August 15th. In the West, we refer to it as the Assumption. They refer to it as the Dormition, which means Mary's going to sleep. And when you said it's the church that commemorates Mary's death and Assumption, I said yes and no, because there's a divided opinion among theologians and a division of the theology which the church accepts. Some people say that Mary never died. And
that
so
she merely went to sleep.
Went to sleep. Mm-hmm. Hence the word Dormition. And it's fascinating if you read Pius XII's promulgation of the dogma of the Assumption. He allows for both theological opinions to coexist in the church. He says, when the course of her earthly life was finished, the Blessed Virgin Mary was assumed body and soul. Well, people who believe, as a matter of fact, that she died, physically died, say, yeah, when the course of her earthly life was finished, she died. But people who hold the alternative that she merely went to sleep and then was taken up into the glory of heaven can also be satisfied by Pius XII's formulation.
And there are people who also describe death as eternal sleep.
Sure, sure. And just in the, an important theological point that we see underscored in Pius XII's carefulness, the Church never pronounces on matters that are inessential and allows for a variety of theological explanations as long as that doesn't threaten a truth. And so no truth is sacrificed by holding either theological position. Now, this site, this Church of the Dormition, is one of three or four places that claim that that's where Our Lady died. Some people say she died in Ephesus, some in Patmos. But at any rate, wherever it happened, wherever her passage into eternity occurred, this is one of the places that claims that. And I think a point to underscore here about this particular church is when Pius XII declared the dogma of the Assumption, promulgated the dogma of the Assumption, some people got it all backwards. They said, there's the Catholic Church making up new dogmas 19 centuries after something happened, now they're making up a new thing that Catholics have to believe. Well, no. When a dogma is promulgated, it simply means that something that was always believed has now reached a sufficient level of theological reflection and maturity that the Church can say, this is now proposed for formal belief. Now, I mention this also because some evangelicals will say, well, there's no evidence in Scripture that Mary was assumed into heaven. Well, there is and there isn't. If you look at the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation, there are very, very strong clues that that's exactly what we're talking about, is her assumption. But more to the point, Pius didn't define in 1950 something brand new. This Church of the Dormition goes back to the 4th century. Its existence, its physical existence, points to the Church's perpetual belief in Mary's bodily assumption. And so this is what is commemorated by that physical site. Now, what does the dogma of the Assumption teach us? It teaches us, first of all, the goodness and the importance of the human body. Right now, there are two people in heaven, body and soul, our Lord, the God-man, and Our Lady, his mother and the mother of the Church. In their persons, we have the new Adam and the new Eve, body and soul, which tell us this is the fulfillment of the entire human race. All of humanity, all of saved humanity, is in some sense already in heaven by virtue of the presence of Jesus and Mary. Secondly, Mary, as the first member of the Church, as the mother of the Church, is there precisely as the Church in glory. She embodies the Church in herself. And she, as a good mother, stands at the finish line, beckoning her children to come. And she's there to welcome us to the glory of her Son's kingdom. She's also there, in a very important way, as a symbol of redeemed womanhood. She's the new Eve. Everything that was botched up in the first Eve was repaired in the second Eve. And Mary is a model of true feminism, Christian feminism, what a woman is called to be by virtue of her dignity as a daughter of God. And so all of this coalesces in this mystery of the Assumption. At the Second Vatican Council, there was a big discussion as to whether or not there ought to be a special document on the Blessed Virgin. And those that one would consider to be more traditional or conservative argue that there ought to be, and there needed to be, because we need to highlight the place of the Blessed Mother in the life of the Church. Other people said, no, 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 for this reason or that reason, we're not going to move in that direction, but let's include her in the document on the Church. And so the eighth chapter, the last chapter of Lumen Gentium, as a matter of fact, is a sustained theological and spiritual reflection on the place of Mary in the economy of salvation. And what does that do? It inserts her into the very heart of the Church. And as a result of that document, Paul VI declared Mary to be Mother of the Church. And in her, the poet Wordsworth says, is Mary is our tainted nature's solitary boast. Everything that could ever be good in a human person is in her. Cardinal Newman refers to her as the daughter of Eve unfallen. We tend to think of original sin as something, a black mark or a this or that. No, sin is an absence. And what's interesting to reflect on, Adam and Eve were created without sin. And so when Newman says that Mary is the daughter of Eve unfallen, by her immaculate conception, God's intervention at the very moment of her creation, her conception, he has preserved her, and he has made her very much what Eve herself was. Sometimes people say, well, if Mary was conceived without sin, no wonder she didn't sin, and she couldn't sin. No, no, she could sin. She could have sinned. Eve was conceived, was born without, was created without sin, but she sinned. Adam was created without sin, and he sinned. No, it's a question that her entire orientation from the moment of her conception was a response to the grace that was given to her. And therefore, she stands again at the finish line as a model, but also as an intercessor, as a mother, bidding us to follow her example and giving us confidence that her intercession, as a matter of fact, will bring us safely home.
Father Peter Stravinskas is a noted Catholic scholar and author and editor of The Catholic Response. That brings our program to a close today. Thank you for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudator Jesus Christus.